Banana, snap, snap. In honor of the Addams Family, the animated one, what newspaper comic strip needs to be an animated film?
I'm Katie Rich, and I think an animated film about aging hippies could be great. So hear me out. Doonesbury, the movie.
Just what the kids have been waiting for. Speaking of which, I'm Matt Patches, and I'm going to say, give us the funky Winker Beanverse, including a crankshaft Disney Plus series.
I did not understand any of the words that just came out of your mouth.
Read a paper.
Hi, I'm David the Seven, and I'm going to go with The Far Side, even though I don't know what it would be about. Someone should pay me to figure that out.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and I am going to go with Kathy, because ack, it's time.
That would be the teaser poster.
So Kathy is like untitled,
it would
Kathy
be a
is like
silhouette
Joker.
Of Kathy and then ack under it.
No, Kathy
know.
Is like Joker, except instead of her condition being laughing, it's ack.
No. Even better. It starts with the untitled Goose Games thing, and Kathy's head pops out of the bush and says ack.
When you call me out, can you call me Kathy?
Ack.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good. Then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room. It's episode 274 and three quarters, and it's the week of Wednesday, October 9th, 2019. On that day in 1986, Andrew Lloyd Webber's Phantom of the Opera premiered in London.
In sleep, he sang to me. In dreams, he came.
I love it when Dave's secret musical theater side comes out on this podcast.
Dave, didn't you go as the Phantom of the Opera once for Halloween? No, wait. That
no,
was
you
a,
went as the guy from Boardwalk Empire.
Boardwalk Empire.
Yeah, that's true. I was thinking about Red Death version of Phantom of the Opera for this year, though, because I could get a red suit.
Mm, and then you could be Joker next year.
Oh, yes. It's not this year, though.
Before we start with reviews, I want to promo that, as you might have noticed from the number, next week we're doing the Quarter Quell, and we figured we'd share in advance so that maybe you guys could watch along with what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about our picks for a movie of the decade, either personal favorite or what we think is most relevant, or both, maybe. We're going to be talking about Lincoln, The Wolf of Wall Street, The Social Network, and The Comedy. So catch
but
up.
But the challenge, the suspense for the next week is if you can match
who picked which. Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, the real challenge is making time for 2 3-hour movies. How long is Lincoln?
Lincoln is two and a half solidly. Okay. And I think
Lincoln is a tight five. I remember correctly.
And Social Network, I think, is a solid two. Lincoln is on Netflix. I don't know about the rest.
If you
of them.
Have to rewatch The Social Network, I don't want to know you.
I mean, I've Please. Seen it in GIFs for years now, but is that really the same?
Mark!
You anyway. Huh?
There.
Mark! Anyway, join us for the Quarter Quell next
don't
week.
Don't fish, eat other fish.
It's going to be fun.
It will be fun. It'll be serious. It's serious fun.
Yeah, serious fun.
Wait, hey, David, do we have reviews?
Yeah. Oh boy, do we ever.
Oh boy.
Can't skip our favorite segment of the podcast.
Yeah, everyone's favorite. Let's do it. Andy Keithley says, just turn the horn down, please. 5 stars. Really enjoy the podcast and love the fact you all disagree on a lot. Just please cut the volume of that clown horn in half. Please and thank you. Dave, was this review helpful?
I mean, I guess we could turn the volume down. Everything, though, it was peak limited, so I promise I'm not blowing out any speakers. Everything is max. 16 luffs. -16 luffs.
When you, we could cut out a clown horn and replace it with just Joker's laughter.
Ooh, people would love that.
I almost put the goose honk in at the beginning of last week's episode, restrained myself at the last moment.
Oh.
We have another review, it seems, from What Is Hot May Never Pie, who may have erased their previous review and put this one in instead. Is this a weekly tradition? Tune in to find out. I don't know. Don't give them any ideas. They say, hi, 5 stars. I love your podcast. I don't remember what they said last time, but I don't know if it was quite that complimentary. Anyway, I've been listening to so many episodes, usually out of order, and with special consideration to certain movies I wanted to hear you all talking about. Noticing that there seems to be no historical rhyme or reason to who is on the podcast which weeks, except when there's a film festival, I become increasingly on edge when you guys do the lightning round, just waiting to hear whose sweet voices will be on the episode. I sit there in anticipation, not even caring about the answer most times, with bated breath, holding the inside of my arms from each elbow. When that final dull cross-eyed from David comes in, oh, a small smile, cross-eyed, his smile curls its way across my face. Before you say it, David, yes, the absences are detailed in the show notes. I was too hung up on cross-eyed to point out that logical failing. But I listen to the car and never read those. Question for Dave. Patch has offhandedly recommended The Boys to you a few episodes ago. Did you watch it? I think you would like it. Question for Patches. Are you excited for The Last of Us 2? Who gives a fuck what Patches has to say about The Last of Us 2? I love The Last of Us.
I don't even own a PlayStation.
Jesus Christ. This whole review was decidedly unhelpful, but I don't know. It hinges on Dave's review of The Boys. Dave, did you watch The Boys?
I have not watched The Boys yet, unfortunately. Oh. That's not saying I'm not going to watch it. It's just, you know, things.
You're not going to watch it.
I'm a busy boy. I like the idea of speedsters just ripping a guy's face off. Why not? I read Irredeemable. Why wouldn't I like this?
My hot take is The Last of Us is the best zombie movie never made. But no.
Sam
no
Raimi wanted to make it into a movie. Would it be a good movie? What's the point?
What's that? Yeah, I mean, it was the best zombie movie never made. Shouldn't have been a movie. Perfect in the incarnation that it was. Very nervously excited for the sequel. Milo Labine says, I love this podcast. Little Gold Men sent me here.
Yeah.
What's the origin? Is it like PewDiePie sent me here? What's the origin of that expression?
I don't know. PewDiePie? Really?
Old time businesses?
No. There's like a certain genesis of it on the internet. Anyway, I started listening to this podcast over the summer during my internship. I'm a journalism undergrad from Northern California with a passion for film. So this podcast is right up my alley. While everyone usually leaves a review talking about David, sometimes for the worse, if I might say, I just wanted to give Katie a shout out as I really look up to her as a female editor in entertainment journalism.
Whoa, thank you.
I love the balance between the four of you and think all of your perspectives make for an entertaining and fun listen. Thanks for always making quality content. I look forward to a new episode every week. P.S. David, I just noticed the other day when I put on Mistress America that your 5-star review was on the cover of the Blu-ray. I don't know if I knew that.
Hey.
I'm sure you knew about this. I actually don't know if I did. But I just thought it was cool because it was one of my favorite films. This review was helpful in several ways. A good shout out for Katie.
Good shout out for Mistress America. Great movie.
Good shout out for Mistress America.
Yeah. It is interesting every once in a while to be in a theater and to have a David Ehrlich quote pop up on the screen and... Everybody I'm with goes,
just fucking loses their minds. It's pandemonium. Even the people you're not with.
The word, our faces melt and our heads pop as
it
the
is
word
like
of God.
The Ark of the Covenant
gets beamed into our irises and our brains attempt to translate it.
J Money Honey Bunny says, it's great to be fine. 5 stars. I love this podcast. A few years ago, while I was driving for Uber and Lyft, which always felt like rooting for the Rangers and the Islanders, but also I respect that people need to do it to eat, so maybe it's not the same. I listened to your 2-hour Top Tens episode, also subjecting my passengers to it. Oh, I like that. I was instantly hooked. All of you have your distinct perspectives, and all of you look for different elements in each film that you talk about. It's fun for me to try and guess each week what each one of you will think of a new film based on what I've gathered about your tastes. Your disagreements are far and away the most compelling part of the podcast. A compelling of any film podcast. Ooh. Keep up the chaos. I like that too. David Ehrlich, I want to thank you specifically for championing Madeline's Madeline last year. It is one of my favorite films of the decade, and I'm so happy to share my enthusiasm with you. I don't think enough people talk about the film. Love you guys. Keep it up. What a lovely review. Yes, Madeline's a masterpiece. You have clearly very refined taste.
What would you do if you walked into a Lyft and it was playing our podcast?
That would be...
What would I do?
What would any of you do?
Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Have a silent ride to wherever
try
I was
not to be found out.
Put a coat over my head. Pretend I'm drunk.
You can't say anything, right? At that point, you're fucked. Like, your voice is your giveaway.
Or give the person the gift of having their person... I mean, unless they, like, hate the podcast, then maybe it's best not to go. But I don't know. It seems like a nice person to talk to.
Yeah, that would be very sweet. That's
just scared of people.
Yeah, that is a very nice review. Thank you. Very helpful for all of us. And finally, I'm in love with Ginny Weasley. who leaves no ambiguity as to who they're in love with, says, a podcast indeed. This is one of my favorite film pop culture podcasts to listen to. The hosts are funny, relaxed, and have a good rapport between them. I started listening to them a few years ago after I just watched Doctor Strangelove because I finally got the reference. Hey, overall, great podcast. I do want to take issue with one little thing. Ooh, bets on what this one little thing might be. I have no idea. I want to say it's going to be Patches related. It's just my guess. I got a gut feeling. I recently went back and listened to the It Chapter 2 episode after I caught up with the film, and I was ecstatic to hear that somebody else had read Paul Auster's City of Glass. However, somebody, I think it was Patches, boom! said it would make an awful film. I disagree. I think the surreal mystery could make a wonderful transition to the big screen as a neo-noir under the right director. This is David now, maybe Edward Norton? I'm in love with Ginny Weasley, says Aronofsky, Kaufman, Von Trier, the Coens, Lynch. I think Josephine Decker, wow, a theme to all the things here, director Madeline's Madeline, in particular could capture the slow descent into madness and the concrete jungle slow absorption of the main character. That does kind of sound up Edward Norton's alley, but I'd rather
watch
this.
Many would try and many would fail in this.
It would be a weird film, to be sure, but a filmmaker with a bold, surrealist vision could adapt it. Curious to hear your thoughts. Anyways, thanks for reading this. Best wishes. Caleb from Williamsburg, VA. Very helpful review. Patches, do you want to expound upon?
My thought is I don't think it would make a good film that anyone would actually fund, but I think that Bill Plimpton, the illustrator or the animator, could make a really good film out of it. And that's my final comment.
Well, this was a wonderful review segment. Thank you all for leaving reviews. I encourage the rest of you to go on iTunes, Fighting in the War Room. Leave us a review. We will read it cold on the show. We really appreciate it. It helps us find new listeners who can then leave us reviews. And so the circle of life continues. Thank you.
This week sees the release of a new film by acclaimed two-time Oscar winner director Ang Lee, and it's called Gemini Man. It stars Will Smith, who I guess makes movies now. He seems like he took some time off to think about his life.
Hard diss on Bright. That's a movie?
To be in no, I will never forget Bright. We all remember Bright. We're all waiting patiently for Bright 2. But in the meantime, he's making theatrical movies where only people who can get to the theater see them. But I gotta say, for me, this new movie is a reason to go to the movies. I think this is a theatrical event in the truest sense, like almost divorced from the quality of the movie, which is going to be polarizing for people, might be polarizing on this podcast, but I really enjoyed this movie as a film buff, as someone who got into movies and learned about movies and is obsessed with both the making of movies and the enjoyment, the pure fall back into your chair and let the world fall away and immerse yourself in movies person. It's all there on screen for me in Gemini Man, this movie where Will Smith stars opposite himself thanks to basically the same technology that brought the Na'vi to life. Young Will Smith Jr., as he's known in the movie, is the young assassin pursuing Will Smith's Henry Brogan, who blah 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 90s thriller generic action plot that you'll watch on cable or a plane or something and have a fine time with. He's on the run from the government. Doesn't really matter. It's so basic, and it reminds me of how Avatar got slammed and I think excelled both because the script was so simple. We've done this story a million times, but now we can graft an interesting kind of, well, in this case it's multiple technological twists. Ang Lee has decided not only to completely rebuild Will Smith using digital technology. This is not de-aging that you see in Marvel movies. This is a complete Na'vi rebuild by the Weta team. And he shot the movie in 120 frames per second, 4K, 3D. No one will probably ever see it that way. For people who, I think, David, you and I got to see it in 120 frames per second, 3D, in 2K, which is weird.
Pathetic.
No
pathetic
one will 2K. Actually.
Yeah. Why? That seems so like you.
Because
you were so
the theaters
close
are not equipped to do it.
The isn't there? Are not a to do isn't it. New York one of the like four cities in the world that's equipped to show it the way it's meant to be?
there are 14 theaters, and you can read about this on Polygon this week, but there are 14 theaters in America that are playing the movie in 120 frames per second, 2K 3D, and no one is playing it in 4K 3D.
So no one is playing it the way it's meant to be seen.
Humans aren't ready to see this movie.
Well, Ang Lee would tell you that's right. Well, that most people are not ready because we haven't been trained to see this movie this way. And he's been staring at high frame rate footage for like the last decade and is obsessed. He'll never make another movie. I spoke to him over the phone earlier this week and he told me that he watches 24 frames per second movies. Normal movies and is disgusted.
What? You mean he watches the masterpieces he's made in his career and feels nothing?
He thinks Life of Pi is a bad movie. Like, is
Life of Pi? I mean, Crouching Tiger, Lost Caution, Brokeback Mountain.
Trust me, he sees problems.
Ang Lee is not
he sees problems. He's a neurotic man, but he also is completely converted to high frame rate. You know, every second of Gemini Man, you are thinking about the image and how high frame rate is making some scenes more interesting. Like, oh wow, this dialogue scene between Will Smith and Mary Elizabeth Winstead. That is, she plays just another FBI agent who was going after him and somehow wooed. And now
they have a phenomenally strange meet cute.
It's a little weird. And they also, there's so many zingers in this. At some point, Mary Elizabeth Winstead is like, loading her pistol. She's like, is it gun time? And Will Smith walks in and says, no, it's not gun time, it's coffee time. And that's probably
it's
my favorite
like
line
that.
Of the year.
No, the best the best line is in the final scene of the movie, so I don't want to spoil. I mean, I don't even think it's a spoiler because you know that Will Smith is going to talk
Gemini
to
man.
Himself yeah. at some point.
We're Gemini
and he says,
man.
If I was you, to his younger clone, and he goes, well, I guess I kind of am you, and it killed me.
Wow.
Sorry to ruin the best moment of Gemini Man. But yeah, I really
ruin.
Miss,
well,
miss
those dialogue scenes all have this, you know, this effect that people kind of saw in The Hobbit, but at 48 frames a second, I felt like this was nothing like what I had previously seen in attempts like in The Hobbit. I didn't get to see Billy Lynn's halftime walk in the very few theaters that it screened in high frame rate or at the New York Film Festival where it premiered. I didn't get to see that.
Oh,
but
you,
really
you didn't see Billy Lynn. Okay.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
So this was a vast, vast improvement over Hobbit because the scenes where they're just talking really feels like you're standing on stage with them. It's like watching a documentary footage. There's scenes where they go to South America and he shoots so many wide shots that it looks like a documentary. And then all of a sudden Will Smith is running across screen with a handgun. And you're like, whoa, wait, this is a movie. It's just a really surreal experience. And sometimes there are high highs. I think there's a fist fight between Junior, the digital recreation of Will Smith, and actual Will Smith that is pretty visceral and incredible to me. Seeing it at 120 frames per second. And then you have things like this motorcycle chase that is all over the trailers that has to be completely rethought. It's more interesting than it is compelling as an action set piece because the high frame rate slows down the movie. Like, you cannot shoot horizontal speeding vehicles here. Suddenly you have to rethink how to make really fast motion more interesting. So he uses kind of like quick camera pans and first person perspective, and he's really trying to compensate. He has to do the same thing for Will Smith, who, look, he's an athletic guy, he's in his 50s. But when he runs across frame or like a courtyard in Portugal or whatever, or where are they? Portugal, South America? I forget. He's
they're in Colombia.
They're Colombia. He's not that athletic. Like, it looks like he's kind of just hobbling around. He's not a stuntman. He's not really fast. There's a lot that Ang Lee has to do to compensate for the frame rate. So is it always good? I don't know. There's a huge set piece where they're blowing up tanks and like shooting machine guns in a town square. And it really feels like standing on the stage of the Indiana Jones stunt show at Disney World because you're up close and you can see how all the stunts and violence are manufactured. And then 2 seconds later, they're like a Gatling gun is ripping through a bodega. And it's horrifying because the bullets are coming by so quickly and everything's exploding. And then he can kind of cut to or segue into slow motion. And it's really astounding. I this kind of blew my mind, and I'm hard pressed to say it's going to work for everyone or that it can be divorced from this technology to be enjoyable. It's really a basic 90s thriller that you'd watch on cable at like 3 p.m. sleepy, but in this tech, in with this like gussied up by Ang Lee, it's awesome.
But will any of us ever see it properly, Gus?
No. Well, so all the 3D showings across America will be in 60 frames a second. So you'll see it. Most people, if they pay for the 3D.
So you think the 60 is as interesting as the 120?
I don't know. I have to assume it pretty much looks the same, but
I don't think half measures are going to do this movie any favors, in the technological or narrative departments. I think, one of the reasons the movie is purely on a story level isn't as interesting as it could be is because it's such a streamlined sort of resurrection of the 90s Bruckheimer template. So, yeah, there's so many so many dynamics that go unexplored in this story, and they only really crack into them in the very last scene in a sort of cheesy way, but there's so much left on the table, so much meat on the bone. It's kind of frustrating. And whenever you are, you know, ironically, whenever your eyes do adjust to the technology is when you are most bored by the experience, because everything else is not really working as it should be. There are so many clunky lines and everything else. And I think what Patch has said, which really rang true to me, is that there are moments where the 120 frames per second feels like this really interesting way of looking whatever Engley happens to be showing you. And then there are moments, oftentimes in the same scene, sometimes a shot or two away, where it is sort of glaringly distracting and feels very inauthentic and puts you out of the movie. So it's an interesting experience. I am phenomenally unsold on the 120 frames per second experiment. As I often cite on this podcast, it feels to me like the latest iteration of the myth of total cinema and sort of like asymptotal relationship to reality and trying to get closer and closer to it and only pushing you further and further away. But I do think some of the shots where they have this extreme depth of field that isn't really possible through other means are interesting. I like that there are shots where there's like cans knocked over in the middle of an action scene and it slows down. You can read the ingredients, the calorie counts on the back of a can of food. I don't know what greater purpose that serves, but it's interesting to think about in lieu of being able to think about anything else. And also Benedict Wan is in it and he tongue kisses a plane at one point, which I thought was cool.
All bets are off in 120 frames.
Dave, where are you feeling? Knowing that you can't see it in 120 frames per second, are you interested in seeing this at all?
Yeah, I definitely still want to see it in the highest frame rate possible. I guess I'll have to go to Polygon to see if I'm going to be able to drive to one of the
theaters. Wait, I'm sorry. You can see this movie in 120 frames per second because the Flatiron Crossing 14 in Denver, Colorado is playing at 120 frames. So basically any Dolby-equipped theater. I'll run them down right now. There's one in Miami. No, I'm not going to do this. Never mind. Go to Polygon. There's 14 theaters. I don't need to name them all, but if they, if you're local,
don't go to my
multiplex,
website. I'll just keep listening to the podcast. Yeah. I'm gonna definitely, if I can go see it at the Flatirons Mall, then yeah, I'll go see it at the Flatirons Mall in 120 frames per second because, like, you know, as we discussed last week, I'm a big proponent of higher frame rates in our visual entertainment at this point. I definitely see, you know, sort of what Ang Lee's talking about, I get the theory of what Ang Lee's talking about, like not being able to watch 24 frames a second movies anymore, just because like I have a lot of old media that I saved on hard drives from like the days of piracy that I was like, this is a good enough quality. And now I like look at it, and I'm like, this is trash and old internet was horrible and I need to buy Blu-rays and DVDs and stuff. So I imagine it's the same thing if you're sitting around watching cuts of something at 4K, 120 frames per second for 8 months, and then hear that like a theater is going to bust it down to 60 frames per second and 2K. Not great.
I just Googled Gemini Man 120 frames per second locations, and it says Gemini Man, quote, a true event film. Guess whose quote that is?
That is my quote. My quotes are being used heavily in marketing, and it troubles me, but I can't
believe you're the only person who liked this fucking movie. But
I am a rare tomato.
That's fine, Sean Edwards. Let's move on.
Wait, I have one more question about Gemini Man for you, David. We talked a lot about the high frame rate, but you know, this young Will Smith is a pretty miraculous special effect.
No.
Well, or maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I'm curious if you feel like over the last 10 years or 20 years almost, since Gollum, is this transformative? Is this effect
working?
I think
it's funny that you mentioned Gollum because that was my exact reference point when young Will Smith popped up on screen. I was like, he
so
looks
much
like
better
Gollum.
Than that.
Not that he like, you know, physically resembles Gollum, but the texture of his CGI skin and the way that it moves.
Really?
It's like his whole body and his eyes, it feels like a souped up Gollum.
Really? There's a scene where he is just furious with Clive Owen, who plays his surrogate dad's, and he's also the FBI agent hunting down real Will Smith. And Junior is weeping because he just realizes he doesn't have a real dad.
And he's
I thought that was pretty affecting. I like that scene.
It's definitely more convincing than The Irishman. And I think between all of the 120 frames business and everything else that was going on, there were definitely long stretches of the movie where he was on screen where I was not focusing on the de-aging technology. And that's basically as kind as I can be to it. For some reason, and maybe I should look at Captain Marvel again to be sure, but for some reason, I remember the de-aging for Samuel Jackson being just like leaps and bounds better than...
It's not de-aging. He's a puppet.
Well, whatever they did.
A Will Smith puppet.
No, you're the puppet.
I see what you did. Yeah, whatever they did here.
They
made
a character that he performance captured that is himself. Right. Not correct. Them taking the correct actual textures and repositioning.
Which Ang Lee
right
would not.
So you have the Irishman on one side, you have this on the other, and then for whatever reason, Captain Marvel is still the one that worked best for me.
Wait. Dave's making a money motion.
That's why it looks better. Anyway.
They spent less money.
Wait, I'm looking
let's move
at
on
the
and let's,
IMAX site says... showing Gemini Man in IMAX 3D Plus and HFR, but it says it's showing it at 60 from 120
where?
Frames master.
Where?
The IMAX news, and it's got like five locations in California and then Connecticut, Florida, Maryland.
Yeah, only Dolby is showing it in true 120 frames.
Why is this so hard to find?
Because no one really wants you to
120
know.
Frames master.
No one wants you to understand.
Yeah. In an interview published last week, Martin Scorsese, director, heard of him, talking to Empire Magazine about Marvel movies and said, I quote, "I don't see them. I tried, you know, but that's not cinema. Honestly, the closest I can think of them, as well made as they are, with the actors doing the best that they can under the circumstances, is theme parks. It isn't the cinema of human beings trying to convey emotional, psychological experiences to another human being." If you follow us on Twitter, you probably know that a bunch of people have been talking about this. We decided to go around the horn and pick our favorite dumb takes, or bad takes, or annoying takes from the many, many days of Scorsese versus Marvel debate. Should I go first, or... someone else want to go first?
Yeah, I don't have one. So you should.
All right, mine is the people responding to, as far as I can tell, one Twitter person who said Martin Scorsese's movies were all literally one genre, and saying, "Oh, well, I guess that part in Silence where they all talked in Italian accents and whacked people was all one genre." Or how about Alice Doesn't Live There Anymore? The fact that you have seen multiple Martin Scorsese movies and know more than this one, or random Twitter person, I'm very proud of you. Shut up, Patches. What about you?
Oof. I mean, I saw a lot of actual Marvel people comment, like Sam Jackson commented, and James Gunn was going off, and James Gunn was saying how Martin Scorsese's movies meant so much to him. And I'm just like,
James Gunn's take was not great.
None of this makes any sense. Why do people get so mad or think that a lot of people are calling Martin Scorsese a gatekeeper. I don't even know what that means anymore. I'm so disappointed in everyone getting upset about Martin Scorsese drawing a line. I guess Marvel movies aren't cinema. I love them. We talk about them all the time here. They're not cinema in the sense that the way Martin Scorsese sees cinema. That's his definition. Who cares? Who cares?
Dave.
Yeah, no one can decide what cinema is for you if you don't want them to. That's don't give Martin.
Except the Russo brothers aren't cinema.
Head unless you look. We're a podcast predicated on arguing points like that, so I'm not going to say having those arguments are without merit, but don't get all like tussled up about it, because no one could just sit down and define cinema.
Not even Martin Scorsese.
Well, I think it's especially not an old person, but it will, you know, given...
Hey, the only person pushing us forward into the future is Ang Lee.
The only one.
He's not young.
David, sure. What's your worst take on Martin Scorsese?
Oh, I mean, I don't, I, me, I have terrible takes about everything. My worst take about Martin Scorsese is probably, well, I don't want to spoil next week's episode. So you'll have to tune in.
Wow. Anyway, everyone stop letting Martin Scorsese get under your skin. Go see Marvel movies and go enjoy theme parks. They also are
what
fun.
About the reverse? Can we just also endorse the reverse? Like
endorse Marvel movies?
Why are we so defensive about Marvel movies?
Oh.
No, if James Gunn came out and was like, Martin Scorsese movies are not cinema.
Oh, that would be amazing.
Torch the internet. So no, we cannot support the reverse. Not everything can be both sides, Patches. We should know that.
Wait, I'm not saying the reverse. I'm not saying
there are very
the
fine people on
go see Martin Scorsese movies too.
This weekend, the highest grossing movie to ever open an Oscar.
What a record.
No, that is not the correct title. The highest opening October opening for a film belongs to Todd Phillips' Joker, starring Joaquin Phoenix as the new Joker, who is a man with a mental illness. That causes him to laugh at inopportune moments, let's say. But he doesn't necessarily have to think something's funny to laugh. As a matter of fact, he's a pretty weird dude, and when he does think he should be laughing, he has this very high-pitched, trill, fake laugh. He lives with his mother, who is not doing well in like a late 70s, early 80s Gotham. They're very poor. He is working as a clown that twirls signs and visits children's hospitals and is seemingly having an okay time before his life starts to unravel and he starts to ask some questions about his past and then
always a mistake
taxi driver.
Yeah.
Or
oh,
last,
sorry, that was the
last
was
king of comedy. Last king of comedy. Last,
yeah.
You know, mostly
mixed with Taxi Driver.
It's so indebted, it's really, kind of insane.
Yeah, it's like, at first I was like, maybe I shouldn't bring this prejudgment that Todd Phillips is completely ripping these things off to this movie, but it is very obvious that is what he wants me to be thinking.
Well, originally, Scorsese, who, back in the news, was, I believe, was on board to be an executive producer, and then at some point along the way...
Back
no
when he considered comic book movies to be
right.
cinema.
I would love to know the story.
But then he saw the dailies and he no longer considered
We only have Todd Phillips to blame for all this.
We have Todd Phillips to blame for so many different things.
We do.
Yeah, it's a, you know, it's an interesting movie. People have been asking me if they should go see it. And I guess what I've been telling my friends, so I might as well tell the listeners, is to me, it's not like good enough to necessarily fully confront what it wants to be about, because halfway through it becomes a Batman movie, and those parts really, I think, drag down what could have been a very interesting character performance about a guy that didn't have to become the Joker. So I think the back half of Joker really doesn't hold up to what I think is a pretty good first act. I like seeing City shot this way. I like the Joaquin Phoenix performance before it becomes, I think, a little bit more outsized and erratic for erratic's sake.
Mm-hmm.
And I like the film's narrative before it decides that none of its own narrative matters because it can't be verifiable, which I think really... It's a way out for this particular type of movie that is going to allow it to be discussed like it's super deep, but I think it's actually a way to use a whole bunch of different versions of what this movie could be in a unified version of the film.
I don't know if we need a spoiler segment, but because I think we can speak about what happens.
Let's just say that everything we're talking about is spoilery. Don't hold back.
The movie made $93 million. People saw it.
Right.
Yeah,
something I really wanted to harp on, something that Dave set up very well, and I mentioned today in a piece that I wrote about why I thought Fight Club was sort of the movie that Joker desperately wants to be, is what Dave is alluding to, and sort of the veracity of what is seen on screen, the unreliable narrator and all that stuff, which is kind of obvious throughout, but it opens the door for Todd Phillips to make such a massive cheat in the start of the third act of this movie involving Zazie Beetz's character, where he writes himself into a corner where he can't afford to have to show us Arthur killing Zazie Beetz's character, because then we won't be able to cheer him on, so to speak. And he can't afford to not have Arthur kill the character, because then it won't galvanize his transformation to the Joker and raise the stakes to the level where they need to be. And there is no way out for that, because it is an impossible compromise in a film that doesn't have the courage of its conviction, that doesn't have the desire to actually push through any of the problems, that it doesn't really do a good job of articulating, and challenge them in any way. But really just sort of wants to wallow in the grime and the anger and the very poorly defined mental illness that this character is dealing with. And then I feel like the movie is sort of leaning on its crutch. And I was already sort of bored by that point of the movie, but yeah. After that, I was just angry at it.
So, well, I think what you're saying is that because he can't have him kill the Zazie Beetz character that he's imagined this relationship with, he then brings in this guy who he used to work with, who we're supposed to believe he has some kind of like rivalry with and was mean to him, but that is not especially well established. Then he kills that guy.
Nothing in the movie feels like it's built organically out of character or dramatic moments that take place earlier in the film or in the history of these characters. Everything in Joker feels manufactured, and it feels like a movie from the very beginning. And it's so relentlessly boring because of that. Like there's no moment that feels like it's has momentum. It's all, okay, now I need to move this pawn into this place and this needs to happen because it's a movie. And then it's a movie. So then we need this, like the Joker needs to murder someone. And then, okay, we'll have like a cool flashback where here's a twist. This isn't real. It's a movie. So maybe we should have that thrill. Like nothing, this is not real drama. And that's what was so frustrating to me, that you have a performer like Joaquin Phoenix who wants to tackle something. He's finding something to chew on here. The performance is physical and visceral, and he's going method. He's unhinged here in the service of nothing.
Yeah.
Like, I kept thinking about The Master after this movie.
Definitely.
So much, because there's someone who's all knotted up in their head and like, what's going on in this guy's brain? But we get so much. There's so much historical, his character, the Master, has a historical place. He's a war veteran. He's seen things. He's carrying this weight on his shoulders. He is lost. He's being manipulated. We can feel the tug. You know, there's just so much going on, even when Anderson's like hovering over him, like in close up. And then there's so many moments in Joker where, oh, this is the 18th time that Arthur Fleck is going to just laugh maniacally for no reason. Yes. There it is.
Yeah.
We know he has a problem, but these moments where nothing is happening, truly nothing is happening. I'm not getting deeper into the character study of Joker. I left the movie feeling like I didn't understand what the point was, what the revelation was, what the, you know, even in the bigger meaning of, I guess, sociopolitical point to make about the forgotten people on this planet. Nothing makes sense, and it all, you know, it starts with someone who thinks the performer can, I guess, pull it all together, but
it made
that
me think
doesn't happen.
So much about the way that directors work, and not just because like Todd Phillips is someone who's been kind of easy to beat up on for a lot of self-created reasons, but he, like Joaquin Phoenix, is doing all these things where he's this character who's like so weird that he laughs weird on the bus and freaks out children, but then also he's like really charismatic when he wants to be, like, and not just in like these fantasy sequences, but like as he emerges later in the film as this kind of like bad guy when he shows up on the Robert De Niro talk show. And like none of those things seem to add up to this character, even in the way that he's like isolated from society. Like you want, if you're going to have someone who's like driven to the brink by being rejected by people, you want to understand why and how he fits into the social fabric of any world that you actually understand. And that like extends to even the way that, and like this feels like a nitpick, but I feel like it says a lot. Like the fact that it's a city where a garbage strike is happening. So clearly there's this kind of organized labor, like uprising of the people happening, but then they also need the Joker to show up and kill some Wall Street guys to like have any kind of like revolution. It doesn't add up to any society or real world that can tamp, like hold all of this stuff in one place.
Hey, Katie.
Yeah.
When you introduce me, could you introduce me as Joker?
David, I'm curious. So after you saw this film at Venice and then watched it win the Golden Lion in horror, is this how you thought it was going to go?
I don't know how to answer that question. What do you, I mean.
Like when you saw it and like people were like raving about it and kind of cautious about it and like there was like no one quite knew what to make of it at Venice, but then it got this big award and there was this moment where you're like, okay, so I guess we have to take this seriously. But did you feel like it was going to land here where everyone's kind of like, wait, this movie is fucking stupid?
I have been conditioned by recent history to, expect the worst possible outcome of all stupid things. So I can't say that I was entirely surprised that this happened. And I remember watching Twitter as the awards were being announced and then becoming more and more real, this might win, and thinking like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the Golden Lion is not the Palme d'Or. I'm not going to sweat it too much. It does make me question Lucretia Martel's tastes, but that's where we have critics because artists can't be trusted.
But don't you think movie would play differently in a foreign country? Like I think
yes, absolutely. That was my experience.
This reminds 100%. Me of how Robert Rodriguez, when he made his first movie, and it was in Spanish and it played at festivals and it was seen as this like art film, and he was like, I just made a trashy shoot 'em up movie, and because it was in Spanish, all these foreign audiences were like, wow, this is art, man. This is
totally different. I can't speak for what it's like to deal with. And I don't want to say, you know, the Joker is as American as some of the other issues that we sort of lay a claim to, but the feeling that I had watching the reaction to this movie was not entirely dissimilar to the feeling that I had watching the reaction to, or at least, you know, a corner of the reaction to Nate Parker's American Skin, which was widely and deeply loathed by every single American critic I spoke to, but had a much more positive reception. According to some of the European critics, it was the same vibe. I can't speak for them. I'm not in their lens, but I don't know. I don't know. I am not surprised at the reaction. I do think that there was, the setting of launching Joker in that festival and then it winning, did set a certain narrative for it. And then I think that some of the things that happened in the week of the film's release here, especially Todd Phillips opening his mouth and talking about how, you know, essentially confirming everyone's most cynical. Ooh, sorry, my dinner is here. Hold that thought. Someone take over.
Well, I want to cut through that. I actually want to, I hated this meta conversation about Joker because
the one that
it
we're
piles
having right
all
now.
This. I mean, yeah, and I want to cut through it and ask you a better question in a second, Katie, but. All Todd Phillips' comments about like woke culture killing comedy and this kind of aura that Joker has about inciting violence and whether it's a movie that's pro or anti incels or something. It's all muck. Like it's not actually part of what this movie ends up offering audiences, which is nothing. Like I was kind of astonished after watching Joker and how little I got out of it. I thought it was so boring. I thought it was so shockingly, surprisingly boring that there was not, like, what's the best scene in the movie? Do you think, here's my question. Dave, Katie, do you think Joaquin Phoenix is, like, really good in the movies?
So, okay. What is good in terms of the dancing?
The dancing is good.
The dancing I thought was great.
Down those stairs is great.
But the thing, the dancing, not to the glitter.
That song is such a nightmare.
That song.
Not even because of what Gary Glitter did. It's such a cliche.
No, it's just a dumb.
No, I actually didn't really know what Gary Glitter did until this afternoon, but, I was not, it affected my initial reaction to it, which is the same as it is now and what Katie was saying. Like it is really obnoxious, but the idea of the dancing and the other scenes where he's dancing, the score, I think is the one element of the movie that is sort of outside of very simple screenwriter logic and does hint at something sort of deeper and unknowable about the
score.
The character.
Mm-hmm.
when he's dancing to the score.
No, no, not the score. The scene where he's dancing to the score.
Oh, okay.
I didn't feel like that quite scene. As passionately about the score as you do.
Oh,
but
it was so overbearing. It was really a comic book movie. This whole movie trying to be a serious drama. We're getting rid of all the Batman-iness out of the Joker tale. This is hard-boiled.
The score is the only thing that's passing judgment on any of the characters, and it's the only thing that tells you when you're supposed to be surprised. So I kind of enjoyed the score because I knew what I was supposed to like be going into. But to go back to what Patch has asked before, I do like the performance. And the thing I said before about like this movie isn't good enough to address any of the issues it comes up to is it did shock me in the movie that it looks like he's going on the show to commit suicide and he decides to turn that into violence that becomes a riot, because that feels like a really timely way to deal with things. The sad thing is it comes after you piled it on top of like a fucking subway shooting and like all these clowns holding up signs that say resist. And I'm like, resist and like blue collar things are like not these weird, scary mobs that you like make them out to be. I'm unsure where I'm supposed to feel about this. The movie doesn't take a stance on any of the issues it brings up, but I do think at least there's peaks that whatever Joaquin Phoenix is dealing with to play the character is like a more interesting version of the character. The movie's just not interested in answering those questions. Like,
we're not even answering them, but framing them in a more interesting and nuanced
and
way.
And giving them a coherent direction.
The questions seem worth answering. Right. I mean, it's so unspecific throughout. And this is one of the things that I appreciated about Fight Club, as smarmy and self-important as a lot of that movie seems now and did even then. It's very specific and detailed in a way that David Fincher is about everything, about the nature of this consumerist world. It's a different world than Joker's dealing with, but it's one that you understand the enemy. You understand what the narrator is rebelling against. And in Joker, it's so broad. It's this idea of, you know, the class issues and super rats. I mean, these are things that the super rats notwithstanding are topical, yes, are relatable, only increasingly.
Well, it's also
so,
things
but they're
that
so broadly
he embraces them, but he doesn't actually, none of his troubles are caused by any of those things. Like, he's all like caught up in being maybe Batman's half brother.
Well, but isn't that true?
He's lost
of, like,
the funding
the,
for
the
his
incel
therapist
movements. But isn't that true of the people who, you know, I don't want to really harp on the insult thing, which has been beaten to death, but isn't that true of sort of the angriest elements of our society right now, who are people who are not angry, or not like their trouble does not come from, SJWs, writing about whatever, but it is a target for their anger. It's what stokes their anger and sort of boils them over the edge. So I think like that's not entirely inappropriate.
Yeah, I don't want to write off the incel comparison that much because I don't think it's as specific like we're talking, but the idea that
either
in 2019 you would look at the world as we have it and the violence that we have and saying a version of the Joker who is kind of a sympathetic loser who's rejected by society is some, and who then like achieves notoriety and fame and like some level of happiness through violence. It's just, it's as irresponsible to me as I thought it was just from watching the trailer. It's not that I think that all
yes,
art has to be morally correct.
Like,
I think
like
that that's a bigger conversation, but it just still feels
like
such
smarter
a
people
terrible
to
take
together
on a character at this particular
wish
time in
the movie
history.
In terms of pieces.
I wish this movie could feel irresponsible. I wish this movie
no, you
had
don't
a kind of venomous brain in its head that would allow it to feel that way for me. This movie is nothing. It thinks we're all very dumb. But then doesn't like be manipulative about it. It actually just does nothing to it.
It's like
all
you're so
emulation.
Dumb, you're not even going
to
get
end
this. If we show you a shot of Bruce Wayne standing by his parents, you'll understand what we're doing dealing with.
You're all so dumb. You think this movie is about you? but I really can't believe that. Like, I laughed out loud. You know, maybe in a way the Joker would want me to when I saw Bruce Wayne's parents get murdered again.
Oh, and the pearls falling off of her neck.
Yeah,
in the street.
I thought that was something that for the rest of my life, I was like, I'm good. I've seen them
David,
get killed.
I think you
so
and I had
times.
The exact same thought at that moment, which was, look, Zack Snyder did this the right way already. We don't need this again.
Can I say that I liked I've heard the a rumor. Scene of him with Bruce Wayne outside the gates? Like the idea
no, you
of
can.
These
I'm sorry.
Two, like, faded people like meeting each other at this earlier point in their life. They're, like the way that it overlapped with the Batman mythology right then. I thought was interesting.
Did your
not that it went anywhere.
Theater? Did your theater laugh when Bruce Wayne went down the pole on his playset?
No, what?
My theater laughed because I think it's a Batman.
It's like a Batcave reference.
Yes, yes.
I mean, there were like four people in my theater, so
dumb.
We all laughed.
That's the thing. That's the things that make this movie dumb. If it was interested in asking the questions about what its main character is, and if it had a message beyond, you know, what happens when you cross like a loner with a society doesn't get him, you get what you deserve, and then Robert De Niro gets shot in the face, and then the movie ends. Like, I would be interested in that, but then again, that's Taxi Driver. Taxi Driver asked the questions, and then you have the movie ends, and you have to sit there with them. This one, it's like the movie ends, and you're like, well, and then Batman's gonna come along. And like, oh, I bet that's him escaping Arkham. There's so many YouTube videos of the Joker ending explained that I like.
Really?
I went through just to see.
I hate our world.
Well, I went through just to see, you know, like the what they made of the bloody footprints. But they are going like so far beyond it to like the entire movie was like he, because there's that early flash where he's in the mental hospital and we think it's the past.
Oh my God.
Think it's the future.
Wait, the bloody footprints is just that he killed that therapist somehow, right?
Yeah, supposedly.
Even with
I don't know. I also the bar for dumbass, dumb shit, dumb fuck fan theorizing bullshit has been set so high with that post about the characters from Midsommar potentially being these two extras in Hereditary.
What?
That I know. Google it or don't. Just live your life. To. It's fine. But none of this stuff really fazes me, but still
look, I don't want to sound like Martin Scorsese here, but these Joker ending explained videos, not cinema.
Yeah.
not cinema at all.
I want to say one thing that I liked about Joker.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't like this movie at all, but I think I should be positive on at least some part of this review. I think Todd Phillips makes funny movies sometimes.
Sure.
And the best parts of this movie are the comedic moments. I think the scene where Joker drops his gun in the room full of like cancer patient kids is pretty hilarious.
Yeah, but it just cuts away from it. Like, it's a funny idea, but they don't really do anything with it.
It's a gag.
But you're also any stable ground with him or this character or the world of the movie that it doesn't feel like you're in a space where you can laugh or know if you're supposed to or like how horribly this is going to go. Like, you're not put in a zone, like, this is something that's like my old, like, film school thing, like the margin of safety in a comedy that allows you to laugh. That doesn't exist in this movie, and I think that's a failure.
Yeah, you're like, oh, then one of these kids is going to get shot because
or, like,
Tom
the scene
Phillips
where, like, he
movie.
Kills his coworker and then the dwarf is, like, trying to get out and he can't get out the door. I think that's supposed to be funny, but it's so grim and unsettling. You don't know if that guy's going to get killed either. Like,
it's
kind of bad.
Funny. It's bad, but it's funny. It's subhuman, like,
it's
laughter,
just
but
not, oh, you think it's
I felt
funny?
I felt a part of me that I had retired from, like, high school come back into my soul. I think that's right. I felt stimulated, and I laughed at that part.
I didn't find anything amusing about this, and I'm glad I saw it in a theater with four people, because if I had been in a theater, like a public screening or a press screening, and there had been a lot of laughter at the end, I don't know how I would have felt about that. I think that there's certainly, I mean, we see movies all the time, particularly of the genre persuasion, that elicit deep laughs out of dark material. But I don't think this movie earns it. And part of what makes it so ugly is that it does feel just like pure rage and bloodlust and not in a productive or well-articulated way. It just feels like people are blindly following the rhythms of this narrative and the way that the movie exploits the superhero narrative and the stock that Joker has now in our culture is pretty galling to me as well. I mean, I think I pointed out that one of the big differences between something like this and The King of Comedy is that everybody comes into this. One of the reasons this movie made $96 million is everybody comes into it looking at the Joker as a sort of pop culture icon, as an aspirational figure, whether they want to or not, and regardless of what the movie's telling them. But Todd Phillips has no time for that kind of context.
I will say, I don't really understand how a bunch of Wall Street bros are that familiar with Stephen Sondheim.
Yeah, that the part where they sense it, that's hilarious.
Sondheim's having a moment. Scorsese's having a moment. it's happening.
It's just setting us up for next year's West Side Story movie.
Bring on Robert Pattinson as Batman. Next.
Wait.
Yeah.
Do you think they're going to make a sequel? Do you think they're going to do a Joker 2? Do you think that...
Is Joaquin Phoenix going to be Joker in the Robert Pattinson? Like, have they been waiting to see what happens with this?
No, it's going
to
be Rihanna and Poison Ivy and Robert Pattinson, and they're not going to mention it. That was it. I don't think there's going to do a Joaquin Phoenix Joker 2. Could you picture... Do you want to be the person that has to sit down and ask Joaquin Phoenix if he wants to do Joker 2?
No. Whatever this is, no, I do not. I don't want to have anything to do with Joaquin Phoenix, but I think that, you know, this is sort of realizing the dream that comic book fans, Dave, I don't want to speak for you, but I feel, correct me if I'm wrong, have had for comic book movies forever, which is that they will spin off into so many different iterations that it will be like the comic books themselves, where you can have these parallel, what are they called? Run. What are they like you have in comics?
Like Elseworlds.
This is how well I know comics.
Parallel universes. Multiverses.
Yeah, just like, whatever. Where it's just like, you know, you can have two different Batman or Batman adjacent sagas going on simultaneously. I don't necessarily think there'll be a sequel to the Joker in a literal sense, but there could be. And then the Robert Pattinson movie could exist somewhere else. And then maybe down the line, they'll do a big crossover event that wasn't built towards with the same sort of strategy that they took with Marvel, but is a little bit more like, oh, this is a fun thing to do.
Have you thought about a YouTube page?
As a fan of IP, I like it, but I don't think there's going to be a Joker 2. I think this is the Joaquin Phoenix.
No, I don't think so either.
As a fan of general IP.
I do like the idea that they're making comic book, like making comic movies that are different things. Like this is such a smarter idea for Warner Brothers to do than Suicide Squad or like the Justice League stuff or anything. Like making something that is artistically different from other superhero movies is a good idea. I just wish this wasn't it.
Yeah, but you know, as I've predicted, I fear a world where everything will become a comic book movie. They will make everything, any kind of movie under the sun, the studios will make so long as they can retrofit it into some sort of, you know, they can attach a comic book character to it in some way, shape, or form.
This is why I have to go see Gemini
and cinema
Man.
Will eat itself.
Gemini Man.
This is why
is
you do have to go see Gemini Man.
Retro sequel to what? Fantastic Four?
No, Hitch. The beauty of Gemini Man is that it's not connected to anything. That is why you gotta go see Gemini Man.
Did you
stay
for the post-credit scene?
You know what? There was
Kevin,
talk about
Kevin
it,
James anyway. Definitely comes out, and Junior definitely decides to be Hitch. I don't want to spoil it for you. All right.
Let's all go eat.
That does it for this week's episode. Once again, we'll be back next week with a Quarter Quell talking about our picks for the movies of the decade. So catch up on Lincoln, The Wolf of Wall Street, The Comedy, and The Social Network, or tweet at us about your own picks. And in the meantime, tell people who you are.
Katie, when you ring me out, can you introduce me as Gemini Man?
Every
I'm
time.
I'm Gemini Man.
You are a Gemini, and, like me.
That's true. We're Gemini people.
Yeah.
I am on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightingintheworld.com. Where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them with friends, or you can share them with your clone, Joker.
David Ehrlich. I am the CEO from Critic for IndieWire. You can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can read my long spiel, which every single person on the internet seemed to love without reservation, about the Joker and Fight Club on IndieWire. And you can leave a review of this podcast, please do, at Fighting in the War Room on iTunes, which I hear is now a separate app from something else. I don't know. They've split iTunes from podcasts. Apple has done something. The
Joker
is laughing at me.
App?
Yeah, I don't know how to leave an app.
Find it. You figure it out and let us know.
I'm Dave with the 7, and you can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can also find me on the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast. This week, we have our finale episode for Season 1, and next week, we're going to go right into Season 2, Episode 1. So, I don't know how much you know about Lost, but you don't have to worry about what's in the hatch for too long. I'll say that.
What's in the hatch?
Isn't it you, Patches? Where'd you go? I don't know anything.
What?
It's you.
What is this twisted plot? Are you the Joker?
I'm the Gemini man. There's two sides of me. I'm Katie Rich. You can find me on VanityFair.com. And on the Little Gold Men podcast, where as promised, we'll be talking about whether or not we have to keep talking about Joker for the rest of award season. So stay tuned for that. In the meantime, you can find me on Twitter at Katie Rich, KateyRich. And we're all on Twitter at FITWR, where, like I said, you can talk to us about your picks for the best movies of the decade. Or answer this week's lightning round question, which was...
In honor of the Addams Family, the animated one, what newspaper comic strip needs to be an animated film?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back talking to you for our Quarter Quell next week.
Bum 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 bum. Now I'm done. We're done.